Accession number 29957, Real 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Vic Tender in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 31st of the Perth, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Vic, obviously we were talking about your experience in relation to flying some of these bigger planes, and you mentioned the Wellington was pretty rough. What was it about flying a Wellington that you didn't like?
Well, the Wellington were quite good in the air. There's nothing wrong with them there at all, but their main fault, as far as I was concerned, is that the trim, it had an automatic trim. Now this is the only plane I was struck with that automatic trim, and they were something I would like them to landing a fast aircraft on an aircraft carrier, that you've actually got to fly them right onto the deck until they hit the deck and then cut your throttles. But they had a big hook hanging out the back to arrest them, and that was the idea of the thing. Well, with the Wellington, it was the same kind of landing. You had to actually fly it onto the ground until it hit the ground and then pull the throttles off. In theory, you held the throttles back with your left hand and the stick fully forward and the right hand. So that, and you held that. You had to hold the throttles off and you'd have to hold the stick forward. Now, I wasn't really physically strong enough, or I don't think I was, to actually hold the throttles off and hold the stick forward. It was a pretty heavy push. So I'd push the throttles off, and when it settled down a bit, I'd put my hands back up, and then the throttles would spring open about, well, I suppose a 16th of an inch or something like that, just a very small amount. But it gave it just enough revs. The engine's got just enough revs to get it airborne again, which was with my hand going from the throttle to the stick, it bounced down the, didn't actually bounce, but it jumped down the runway. That's the only fault I had with them. They were fairly heavy in the air, but they flew all right, and anybody that flew them on a tour of operations would swear by them, so the fault was just mine, not the aircraft.
Let's talk then about the other planes that you would fly and how they compare.
Well, from the Wellington, of course, the only two heavy planes I flew were the Wellington, and it's only two engines, and the Lancaster. So I can only compare it with the Lancaster, and of course there's no comparison at all. The Lancaster was a pleasure to fly. It could trim her up and she'd fly on her own, and it was a very forgiving aircraft. It was a docile, it was flying the way I imagine flying was. You had something firm to handle. It was no final touches or anything. You had to firmly turn it, and with all your controls, it was something you could feel about things that I didn't see in the Wellington, it was much firmer in controls than the Oxford and the Anson, because they are pretty light aircraft, and you had to be pretty gentle with them in all throttle movements or all actually every movement with your feet, with your hands, and then with your throttles. But the Lancaster was different altogether. It was a beautiful aircraft. As everybody else, I think, that flew one had the same idea. Now, the other heavy aircraft, or before that, there was the Stirling. The Stirling was a big aircraft, very high off the ground as far as the undercarriage is concerned. I never actually saw one on the ground, but at one stage they were used in operations, and they weren't a success. And they used them in heavy conversion training to a very large extent towards, well, at one stage of the war. I had a friend in particular, a chap that I used to work with at the government print, who he was killed on a Stirling in training, and he either overshot or wasn't lined up properly and pushed the throttles on to go around again, but they were pretty slow to respond and hit some trees and crashed. So thankfully, when I at the holding centre between postings, when you finished a particular part of your training, you'd move to another holding centre, and they would then spread you out to the different training schools as they were required. And I used to hear some terrible tales about the Halifax, which I don't think were altogether true. So I don't know what the Halifax was like at all. And of course, when the Stirling was more or less cut from operations, they were using those on heavy training too. And I was happy to miss them, of course, and I was very, very happy to do my heavy conversion or the after my heavy conversion, I was very happy to get posted to a Lancaster, because I'd heard so much about them and I found it all to be true.
Let's talk then about your posting and beginnings of operational flying proper.
Well, the beginning of flying operation proper. Look, as I said before, I don't pretend to be an air ace or anything else. I was pretty scared of the whole thing. Not that I'm scared of flying. I wasn't actually scared of flying. That's not the right way to put it. I suppose I might have been scared of operations, but it was more apprehension than scaredness, I think. I went to the squadron. We went by train, I can't remember the things. I went to Mildenhall in Suffolk, and we got off the train at this time. The ground was covered with snow, just after Christmas it was, or just about Christmas time. Yeah, just after Christmas, and the ground was very thick with snow, and we got off at a place called Shippy Hill, and there was a truck waiting there for us to take us to Mildenhall. And I had a hell of a cold when I got there. I was miserable, and so I went to the medical centre first, and left my baggage and everything to the rest of the crew to put away for me or to look after for me, because we were all sergeant pilots at that time, except one who was an officer, and of course that was Jesse James. Excuse me. And he was conveyed to the officer's mess, and the other chaps went to what had been married quarters as the Air Force was a permanent base before the war. And of course in those days the officers could have their families on the station, and they had these double story units that they each family could have, but they were turned into aircrew units, no women on the station, or no married women on the station, and they bunged me in the hospital anyhow, and I was in the hospital for 4 or 5 days, and then when I got out of hospital I went down to the flight office to report in, and they put me onto a cross country that night, which was I suppose a navigational exercise more than anything for the navigator. And there were two of us, another Australian pilot and myself. I never met him, and I never met him. don't know quite what he was like. I was very naive when I got there. I didn't really know what was going on around me. So we went on this flight, on this night, 4 or 5 hour night training trip, and the other chap and his crew didn't come back. They went into the ground somewhere in England it was, but we didn't have to go overseas or across the channel. So I don't know what happened to him, and then from then on I was on or eligible for what they call battle orders. A battle order was, it was actually called a battle order, which was a notice that went up on the notice board as soon as it was decided that they were going to, you know, go on an operation, that the squadron was on an operation. So when this happened, of course, all the stations were locked up, nobody was allowed out, and all communications out of the squadron were cut off, so that no word of this what was going on could be passed on to anyone outside. The first thing we did when we saw a battle order on was to very quickly check up to with the ground staff to find out what the petrol load was going to be, because that could indicate that it was going to be a long trip or a short trip. That was the first thing we do, and then we would the rest of the day was our own, or the rest of the 8 hours or whatever it was before we took off was our own until briefing time. Or before briefing time, you got an operational meal, and being such an important event for everybody that was going, I got an egg on toast as a treat, because the eggs were, you didn't see many eggs in England when I was there. And so we would go and have our meal, and from our meal we go straight to the briefing office or briefing building, where all the crews that were going were assembled there with all the master bomber, or with all the heads of the various departments, like the gunnery and navigation and wireless and one thing another, and the officer in charge of those sections would give a briefing on the trip as to the things that were available to the navigator, positions he could get with on G as far as G was going at that time, and things like this, all navigation news. The gunners, they were briefed too, but there wasn't much to, they were briefed where there was a very good chance of where we would be attacked and all that kind of thing.
The sort of wait during the day presumably must have been a pretty tough thing. Can you describe the atmosphere on the base when everyone was sort of waiting for the brief?
Well, it was... the atmosphere for me was, it was pretty traumatic. I don't know. Some of the others anyhow must have felt the same. But the worst thing about it was that if it was, if you had time to have a bit of a snooze or something, you couldn't get a snooze, because the crews that went on the op, they'd be prancing up and down the corridors, because the officers' mess and I suppose the sergeant's mess had a bar, and they'd go in and get themselves full of beer, and they'd be kicking up all the noise in the world. And I couldn't get any sleep anyhow. But it was pretty traumatic, and I suppose the others felt the same. I don't know.
My impression is that at the briefing, I mean, this was a time when you were actually going to find out where your
trip was going to... Yes, you'd go into the briefing room and they'd have the big map of the continent and spread up on a very huge board, because when you go in, it's covered over. And wasn't that the CEO gave his address that he pulled the curtains aside and told you where you were going? And sometimes it was gas, but people got used to it after a while, I suppose, and did give a sigh of relief when they saw perhaps some of the targets they were going to, while they might have taken a deep breath at others.
Well, what were those targets that got a gasp?
Well, the targets like Dortmund, Stuttgart, Berlin, although I never went to Berlin, but these are the types of things, long trips and pretty heavily defended. Most of the trips that I did were on petrol installations, fuel installations, refineries, storage bases and things like that. Nearly all of my trips were done on these things. We only did one, I can't remember which it was, which was described as a troop concentration, and that was a couple of nights after the Dresden raid, which caused so much, created such a bloody problem, or a lot of controversy after the war, and I think that controversy still goes on, but that was what their target was, that target was described as a troop concentration, where they were concentrating troops to move them well to where they're going to be needed on the western or eastern front. That's what they were described to the crews as. Ours were always, nearly always, industrial. I think there was only one that was, a blanket bombing kind of thing, but I can't remember which one that it was now.
In relation to places like the Dresden bombing, what was in the air around that time that you might have heard in relation?
No, nothing. No, I can't remember any controversy about the Dresden event until much after the war, really. It wouldn't have worried me anyhow. It wouldn't worry me now if I had been on that raid, because you did what you were told to do, and there is no way out of that. And you trusted the people who would. Choosing these targets had a reason to choose them, and that was it. And it wasn't any. I only had one time. I didn't want to kill anybody, really. That wasn't what I was after. And there's one time when I had the choice of dropping my bombs when I liked, and.
You mentioned you carried a load back to England, right?
Rather than
dropping them.
Yeah, this was the case that I was talking about. We were briefed to go to a place called Wanaikul, and I don't think that might be the pronunciation. It's two words, W-A-N-N-E, I think, and then I-E-K. L or EL, I'm not sure, but one equal.
People and talk also of actually in a hairy situation dropping their bombs before they got there and getting out.
Yes.
Did you ever experience anything like that?
This happened, and this is the. You cannot take any great notice of the Bomber Command diaries that were put out by the Air Force or the authorities, anyhow. Like no notice of them at all in the results that they broadcast or that they put into this diary. And One Eagle was a typical example. It was a three group attack, and there was 15 squadron was in three group, it was a daylight, and we were flying in our scraggy type of formation, four blocks of four, I can't remember how many, you get three aircraft in the front with one behind in the centre, lower down, and then the next formation higher above that, and so a number of them all spread out in this gaggled formation. And the leader led us into a towering Q-Nim cloud.
You were mentioning this before.
Yes.
And I was interested that you mentioned some of these things, because my impression is that things didn't always go to plan.
Yeah.
And it was left up to the pilot to decide.
Yes. Well, in this case, you could see this towering Q. I mean, we were at 22,000 feet, and the cloud was, well, just like a, how can I put it, a great big pipe of cloud going straight up into the air and spreading out at the top. But you can actually see, when I say a pipe, it's like it's round, but it's quite huge. I mean, quite wide and quite deep, and you could see the clouds boiling within there. I knew what it was going to be like, and the group leader led us straight into that. Now,
on those occasions where it's been a near death experience, literally, and you're able to make it back, but others don't. How does that affect the squadron? How does that affect the ground, the base, operational?
Well, actually, they only lost one aircraft, but in that cloud, I mean, before I put in that, they could have flown around that cloud. They could have wheeled the whole squadron around and went around the cloud. But that wasn't chosen to be done. And when you got in there, it was rough, I can tell you. I've never experienced anything like it.
So on returning safely yourself on such a mission, and not necessarily in this particular case, but on occasion when another plane hadn't made it back. Mm. How did that affect everyone?
Well, of course, as I said before, I wasn't there in the really dangerous times. That we were in command of the air, and we weren't losing. We were losing aircraft right till the end of the until the war ended, and perhaps even a little while after that. But we weren't losing as many, and we never, in my squadron, we never actually lost. We only lost one aircraft in the time, apart from the chap that went out the same on the night trip the same as time as me and didn't come back. That didn't have any effect on me, and I don't think it had any effect much on anyone else, because nobody knew them. They were really new to the station. And also at that time, when I first got to the station, actually the Air Force is a very bloody lonely situation. It's lonely. It's a lonely service. I'll explain that to you a little later on. But nobody knew this fella, and so nobody cared. And after I'd done a trip or two, well, a lot of people disappeared. They just, there's a flight commander and two or three of the other fellows, or not two or three, quite a few of them, they just disappeared. But they'd finished a tour of operations and were going on their leave, at the end of ops leave, and then get posted out to some training situation and things like that. So we got a new group of people in, from different squadrons, and some new ones like myself, but nobody greeted me into that flight at all. Nobody, when they knew I was going on my first trip, they not one wished me luck or shook my hand or anything like that. They're quite indifferent to it all, and this I found was a bit strange. And when you're on the station, you get to know very, very few others. You've got your own crew, who are a pretty close-knit group, and they seem to, I mean, the gunners in particular, seem to seemed to mingle among the other gunners and things like that more than, well, than pilots did, or more, certainly more than I did. It wasn't often dodging anything, and I'd rather have some friends around me, and it's just that it didn't seem...
People have talked about avoiding getting too close to one another, because you never quite knew if you, you know, got too close that friendship would
yeah,
go
well,
nowhere.
Yeah, it would, would...
People wouldn't come back.
It would stir you up. I quite agree with that, and it was best you stuck with your own mob, and that, well, that's the way it was, because I have some regrets myself about, for instance, where you used to get a week off, I think it was, in every fire, or the fifth week, I can't remember now, but it had something to do with fire. Now, I got two gunners who were English, and I had an engineer, and I had, an engineer, two gunners, and a bomber. All were English, and I should have at least gone home and met their parents on this, on the different leaves. But I had a girlfriend in Melbourne, in London, and I was shot back to London as quick as I could get back there. I did meet the bomb aimer's father. We met him, and the bomb, the engineer. The engineer's father it was. We met him. I took my girlfriend along, and we, both of us, and Eric and his father sat and had a few beers and one thing and another, and quite a good afternoon together. But I regret that I didn't go and see those boys' parents, because they would have got a kick out of that, and that didn't even dawn on me at the time. But, well, that's the way it was. I couldn't... that's one of my deepest regrets, but I, as I say, I didn't think about that.
Mm. So how would your experience progress? How would your operational flying progress?
Well, I was pretty apprehensive and scared, I suppose, early on the piece, and I think this was noticeable to the people who were wise in these events, but it got better and better. So I had a report somewhere that told me that I, you know, a little bit doubtful to start off, but I had picked up confidence as I went along. I don't know if I actually picked up confidence or not, but I did got a little bit more used to it, that's all. Because as far as I was concerned, even though we weren't losing aircraft, it was a pretty dicey thing. And people used to come back with one engine out or something gone wrong. But with all the, well, I say all the flying I did, well, it wasn't a lot of flying, but there's only about 500 hours all told. But I never had a malfunction in any aeroplane that I flew. Nothing. I never had anything go wrong at any stage, not with engine or equipment. My navigator at one stage, who was the officer in the crew, and we were going on a pretty deep night trip it was, and it was the only time that we had to gain height by circling the airdrome. We had to get up to 20,000 feet just flying around our own drone, and then set course from there. But when it came to setting course, my navigator told me his G wouldn't work. That's a ground fixing thing where you could actually, he was a good navigator, he could fix his position within, well, when he's right above the thing, he'd tell you that's where we are. And I said, well, it's still twilight, Jesse. I said, we'll go to the coast and you can get a wind from here to the coast, and you can set that wind and we'll go on with that. And so I got nearly to the coast, and well, got the coast, and I said, now you've got a wind now, Jesse. And he said, "Oh, he said, I think if I turn the G on, get it fixed quick and turned off again, it's all right." So that's what we did. We went on, but he didn't want to go on. He didn't want to. Well, nor did I. But I had to go, and I did get